very gracious and very kind words. And I'm very grateful to you for coming here, especially. Bob came out on the plane with me to introduce me. Bob, you should know, is a matter of great pride to me. He was kind enough to invite me to speak for him when he ran for election here in 66. And I came out, and you can't imagine how rewarding it is to a person like myself to work for a candidate in another state, then have him come to the Senate and realize all the good things that you've said about him. Now, Bob was very kind to me tonight, because I really had occasion to worry about what he might say in introducing me. You see, there's one fact that he did not give you. He sits behind me in the Senate, directly behind me. And I'm sure he's seen me do something odd, doodle, or scratch my head, or worry about my wife, or talk to myself. He mentioned none of these things tonight. I'm very grateful to him. But Bob Griffin is one of our really creative senators. There were four senators who came to us on the Republican side in 66. You know them well: Griffin, Brooke, Percy, and Baker. And I think it is perhaps a whole Republican speech to recount the capability, the character, and the contribution which these men have made, each different and each unique and characteristic of his region. Bob is a member of the Committee on Labor and Public Welfare, as he's told you. We deal with labor matters in which he need yield to no one in his conviction and understanding and his knowledge. And though he came to us with the bill which bears his name behind him, he has earned the respect of the members of the committee and the respect of American labor, because he knew what he's talking about, and he had very deeply in his heart the national, not the sectional or the partisan or the special interest of any group. And I hope very much that Bob may continue with us for years to come, until some other, perhaps even greater office beckons to him, as an extremely able, important, and contributing senator to the Senate of the United States, bringing glory and luster to the name of the state of Michigan in the Senate. I'm very grateful to our dinner chairman, Rodkey Craighead, for the celerity and dispatch with which he has set up the evening for us crisply. And I'm very grateful to all of those who have joined with him, the distinguished people who are here representing the Southeastern Michigan United Republican Fund. I hope you will forgive me if I speak especially of my close and warm, devoted friend, Max Fisher, with whom I have worked so long, and the joy and pleasure that I felt when he was preferred by the party in the state to be its honorary chairman in respect of its fundraising activities. And Max has told me about the indefatigable work of his colleagues, of Bob Weir and Wendell Anderson and Don Ahrens, all of whom honor me greatly by being here tonight. And I'm very grateful to them, and also has spoken most highly of the work of Jack Slater, the executive director of the United Republican Fund. And as I, like every other candidate, will receive some benefit from this work through our own campaign committee and through the national committee, I'm by no means here, as Bob said, I was nice to come from New York, though I'm campaigning myself. I considered it a duty. I can't do enough of this, and the National Committee could not have picked a more felicitous place for me to do my bit than the state of Michigan. So I'm very comfortable here and very glad to be here, and had a very nice visit with Dr. Kilgore, who sat next to me. And before I share with you the things that I have in my mind tonight, I'd like to say a word about your governor, George Romney, and one can't mention George any more than one can mention any of these distinguished gentlemen without the ladies who are here tonight, too, so pleasantly. One can't mention George without speaking of Lenore, his very talented and very gracious lady. I was one of George Romney's original backers. It is a matter of the deepest regret to me, and I'd like Dr. Orlebach to take this message back to him. Matter of the deepest regret to me that he didn't stay in the race. I think a quality of gallantry and high character was contributed to the presidential race by George Romney, win, lose, or draw, which would have had a tremendous effect upon it in the final analysis. This is no derogation of the candidates who were there. I know them both intimately, and it's very well, my sentiments are very well known in terms of my own governor. And this is no night to speak of it. This is a united Republican fund. But I cannot help in Governor Romney's home state but to speak in this uniquely appropriate place, as he is out of the race now, what has been so very deeply on my mind. It was a pleasure, but more than that, it was an honor and a national duty to be for George Romney, and my only regret is that I can't continue to be for him. I might tell you that my governor felt exactly the same way. Now, our party stands at a very important juncture of history. It's always possible when you're a partisan to start a speech that way in any presidential campaign. But I am not a particularly dug-in partisan. I never have been. I represent all the people of my state, 18 million strong, and I don't feel any particular bias against the Democrats or the Democratic Party or the minority parties we have in our state. And I've often thought my party wrong and said so as a matter of national duty, and I've always said, and I repeat here at a Republican gathering, that I'm an American first and then a Republican. But I speak tonight rather feelingly about our party because I deeply believe that we have a rendezvous with both history and destiny, and that what we do as a party is so important that if we fail, we will fail the country, not just our party and our tradition and ourselves. For I deeply feel that the things that trouble the country today, and our country is very deeply troubled, notwithstanding the automobiles in most garages and the television sets in most homes and the other amenities which represent the unbelievable American standard of living for 80% of our people. Our country is very, very deeply troubled and is questioning its most basic values today. And the country deeply feels that it wishes it could, and I use every word carefully, it wishes it could change administrations. The country really wants a totally new team to take over, and it has every reason to want it by virtue of the crises that we face. The question is, will we, Republicans, be equal to this historic responsibility, or will we fail by parochialism, by partisanship, by everybody being in business for himself, or simply by the fact that we have been so long in the opposition that we do not understand how to govern affirmatively? It is no secret to sophisticated people like yourselves that since 1932, we have really been out of power in a party sense. Dwight D. Eisenhower, beloved, great leader that he is and was, and I think he had a fine presidency. I defended it in a great symposium that the New York Times ran, in which I thought they did not give him his due, was a president of national union. In a real effect, the country was in terrible trouble with the Korean War, and it needed a drop kicker to get the 3 points, and it was Dwight Eisenhower who did it. But this is the first opportunity we have had when history meets our party need, and the American people really want a change. So there is more at stake in the coming election than merely a partisan victory. And I say the people want a change for this reason. When you find a deep spirit of disquiet, which leads to such violence in our cities as to raise issues of internal security for the United States and diversion of our effort from national security, which is what the riots following the death of Martin Luther King meant, and what you have experienced yourself in the most agonizing way here in Detroit not so very long ago. When you find youth in rebellion in so many areas of the country, when you find the nation deeply disquieted over a war which it feels it should never have gotten into on the whole and which it wants to get out of, and yet in which it is caught by national responsibility and national authority and the future prestige of the United States, and I don't use that word lightly. Prestige is important. We don't want everybody to test the United States. When the United States says it will do something, we expect the world to believe it will. That's the way to avoid war. The way to invite war is to invite people to test you every time. And then, in addition, when you see the fantastic prospect of a runaway inflation in the United States, of the American dollar at peril, of the American credit system in terms of its world relationship jeopardized, when American tourists can't change the finest currency in the world for foreign currency at foreign airports, even for a day, there's some deep malaise in our country. Now, I don't believe there's anything basically wrong with this nation, but there could be. It is not the first time that a nation which believed itself sick would become sick, and there is real doubt in many, many minds in this country as to the validity of our whole system. Many of the young people on our college campuses are anarchic enough to challenge the constitutional system itself and whether it is worthy of perpetuation as the way in which to run this great nation. And at this particular time in our history, the Republican Party happens to have endemic within itself the very qualities which the country most hungers for. First, it's the party of business. I've never backed away from that. As you know, I have a reputation for being a progressive in philosophy, as Bob Griffin indicated. I'm very proud of it. I believe that with Lincoln, that what the people can't do for themselves has to be done for them until such time as they can't do it for themselves. I'm not one of those people who believes that it shouldn't be done, that they should suffer, and then they'll find a way out someday, sometime, somehow. I don't think that's the essence of government. But nonetheless, I've never backed away from, and I'm most proud of the fact that we are the party of business, because the party of business is what this country needs right now. As every one of the presidential candidates will tell you, right across the spectrum, every one of them says it's only business that can deal with the grave crisis of the cities, that has the resources and the manpower, the technical skill, and the organizational pattern which can deal with job giving and job training and threshold education which we have decided by common consent is the best entry into the problem of the slums and ghettos of the United States. And we are the party of business. And what American would pretend for 1 minute that the business community would rather do business with the Democrats than do business with us? Of course that's not true, no matter how much they may mouth the phrase. And we've heard it time and again in our committee on the Democratic side. So that's one. Second, we're the party of the Union. That's what Lincoln made us. We're the party of the Union. We're the national party. We're the party that knit the country together with a transcontinental railroad. We're the party that opened the West. We're the party that industrialized America in the latter half of the 19th century. We're the party of union. We're not a sectional party. You don't have built-in Southern aristocrats, which is what they are in practical effect, holding the major seniority positions in the Congress of the United States and voting diametrically against and working diametrically against everything every Democratic presidential candidate says. This is the most colossal paradox the American people have ever known, and the Democratic Party has never been called for it. And it's as true as scripture. We are the party of union. We don't have this sectional, parochial interest or this special group interest, whether it's a combination of poor farmers and labor or whatever. We are essentially a national party. And third, and very interestingly, we are the party of tranquility. We are the party of tranquility. I think if the administration is entitled to take the glory which accrues from the advances in welfare and in anti-discrimination, though they did them all with Republican votes, as so many of you may know, then we're entitled to take the credit for the fact that when we're in power, the nation is not torn with riots and violence. There is not any erosion in the morale of our people. And the country on the whole has rarely been at war when we've been in power. We are the party of tranquility. Now these are the very qualities for which our country hungers. It hungers, as Lincoln said, to bind up the wounds and to take care of the widow and the orphan. In the sense of the real malaise which affects our nation. Now, our appeal to the country rests upon very strong pillars. I referred a while ago to the fact that in 1952, President Eisenhower ended the Korean War and at the same time embarked on a program of deliberate and principled social advance. And we had a period of really constructive achievement in our country and real tranquility. And what was done was not in response to violence, but as the result of deliberate and sober appraisal of the country's needs. In domestic affairs, important gains were made in housing, in social security, and in civil rights. And let us remember that the most advanced of the welfare agencies of the federal government, the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, was established under Eisenhower in a Republican administration. And very importantly to us, considering the problems of our day, internationally, the United States utilized its power with discretion to keep the peace and to keep its wealth and to use its wealth with generosity to build a future. And let us remember that the pressures upon Eisenhower to bail out the French in Vietnam were just as great, if not greater, than the pressures upon Johnson and Kennedy to bail out the South Vietnamese under attack from the North Vietnamese. The difference was that he didn't succumb, and they did. Now, may I interrupt parenthetically here to tell you that Bob Griffin will have to leave us in 5 minutes to get a plane. And I hope you will not mind his going.
You don't have to interrupt twice. I'll leave.
You'll leave now. And now to come back to our theme, a of our being the party of business, of union, and of tranquility. The technique which has characterized historically the Democratic side, and after all, I repeat, we're not dealing here with a federal case. We don't have to indict the Democrats or charge them with things for which they may not be responsible. What we have to do is to analyze the framework of history in which respective administrations function and see what history responds to in terms of policy as they characterize the different administrations. Now, in that sense, Democratic presidents from Franklin D. Roosevelt through Lyndon Johnson have proceeded from crisis to crisis, summoning the people with military imagery for wars against poverty, disease, crime, and other obvious ills. Yet these trumpet-like calls for action often obscured the underlying principles of government. Measures introduced in response to a national emergency were attained long after their useful life should have ended, through political expediency or because of special interest. As a result, both the original purpose of such measures and the national interest were too quickly forgotten, and I'll give you a few examples of that. So we have today an enormous proliferation of federal laws and agencies. Can I have some more? Together with accessory local and state bureaucracies that often overlap or conflict with one another. In short, Democratic administrations have tended to overpromise for political purposes at the time of crisis, and later to underperform when the flaws in their legislation appeared. While the Democrats overpromise and underperform, the Republican philosophy is to seek not to exploit crises, but to prevent them. We can do this by keeping the established framework of laws and institutions in good order. But we must, above all other attributes, be problem solvers, not sterile negativists. This has been something which has bedeviled us for a very long time. This role we have on occasion to our great disadvantage espoused. And bearing in mind that we've been in the wilderness for 36 years, you can understand how the habit of negativism could have become endemic in the party. Now, in providing viable solutions to our problems, Republicans should attempt not to expand the control of the federal government at the expense of private institutions. Instead, we need to aid private institutions better to serve the public interest. The great triumph for the Republican way is not, as it is with the Democrats, some majestic, dramatic assertion of the presidency in a time of crisis. The Cuban Missile Crisis, the crisis in the cities, the Vietnam War. But our triumph is the smooth and anticipatory functioning of our laws and institutions within the framework of a durable peace. That is why I said when I began, the Republicans are the party for the people at this time of our history. We know better how to preserve individual rights and opportunities, and we know better how to govern in such a time as this, when the national interest must be paramount over every other consideration. Now, I said we were the party of business. And I said, and I repeat, who can question that business would rather do business with a Republican Party than with a Democratic Party in power? But we have a responsibility, too, which we have not often carried out effectively, and which we have an opportunity to carry out effectively now. Our job must be to see that business serves the public interest, because otherwise we fail in our responsibility. And when we talk now about the tremendous mass movement of business into the problems of the cities and slums, like the New Detroit Committee, which Max Fisher is connected with, and Henry Ford and other leaders of the automobile and other industries here, we talk about precisely that. The fact that our job must be to see that business serves the public interest, just as I feel that Republicans believe that the government must be businesslike and that the federal establishment must deliver a full dollar of service for every dollar appropriated in Washington. Indeed, these principles have been the axioms of my own career, and it's gratifying to see them recognized today by so large an element in my own party. I beg you to understand that it is not without significance that it is I who am a speaker for the National Committee at a party fundraising dinner. This itself represents a milestone in our party, I assure you. Now, when I read the papers or turn on the news these days, I'm amazed to see how the Democratic presidential candidates have adopted, without essential modification even, the principles of local initiative and private enterprise which we've been fighting for and which they've been scorning. Scorning on the ground that business is predatory and therefore under constant suspicion. And this has been true for most of our political lives. Now, I'm no apologist for business, but I realize the enormous utilization to which it can be put, and I realize the concern which we must have for its processes in order not to distort and destroy them. And to give you one example of that from my own career, which is so important to our party, one of the amazing things about our own history as a party is that we have not undertaken what should be for us the most elementary of campaigns, and that is a campaign to review and revise the antitrust laws of the United States, laws which are completely obsolescent, which unduly hamper the capability of business to do exactly the things we want it to do at home and abroad, where we have the unique responsibility for dealing with precisely such problems, and where we have fallen into the same trap the Democrats have fallen into, to wit, we have not seen our creativeness, our role of the constructive alternative in respect of this opportunity. And I mention that only because I know we will do it. More and more support is coming to this measure in the Congress, which I've sponsored for many years now. And the party is beginning to perceive its role as a problem solver. Let me give you another example of that. And it comes from the work of one of these young senators, like Bob Griffin, very creative. And that's Chuck Percy of Illinois, who came to the Congress propagating the idea of home ownership as a very helpful element in the work in housing in slums and ghettos. And we now see that whole operation constructively carried in the new housing bill, which the Senate just passed. Another example of the same thing. We have worked in the Congress for years under the leadership of Winston Prouty of Vermont, a Republican senator, for something called the Human Renewal Act, which would propose to give a tax benefit to American concerns which engage in the training of hardcore unemployed from the slums and ghettos. The Democrats have, in a dug-in way, opposed the concept of tax inducements. Now they are softening their stand upon that, and indeed, knowing that they can't beat us, they're joining us. But this represents fundamentally a Republican initiative, and any businessman will tell you he'd rather have the Internal Revenue Department under Republican administration administering any such law than under Democratic administration. And other developments. The Economic Opportunity Act, that is the anti-poverty legislation, is absolutely full today, based upon my own work in the committee which handles the matter, is full today of opportunities for private enterprise to take over and do the job. We have concentrated unemployment and various other programs. It is just loaded with those opportunities, but they are relatively little utilized. And the reason is that in the administration, which is at least half, sometimes more, than the issues at stake, American business is very wary of doing business with a Democratic administration for fear that it will at some point turn on it. As we saw, a very striking example, which you may remember not so many years ago, in the steel price increase case, when FBI agents knocked on the doors of businessmen in the middle of the night and questioned them as to the whys and wherefores of a price increase. That doesn't make the price increase right or wrong, but the country properly rebel against any such technique in respect of the operation of the American economic system. In addition, there are proposals pending in the Congress of the most creative character. For example, for a replica of the World Bank through a domestic development bank to finance entrepreneurship and small business, especially in slums and ghettos. There are some 80 Republican sponsors of that bill. I happen to be its author, and it is widely considered one of the most constructive and fruitful alternatives for our work in the slums and ghettos of the United States. The National Alliance of Businessmen, which Max is a part and which Henry Ford heads here, needs a corporate embodiment. We have proposed, practically the same group of sponsors, an economic opportunity corporation as the way in which American business can be brought into this struggle in a very effective fashion. Now, these are all new, constructive ideas which are of the most critical importance to us. And taking this very grave racial tension in the cities, we take far too much for granted that the vote of the American Negro is pretty much committed to the Democrats. I met Miss Edwards here, who is the secretary, I gather, of the party in Wayne County, a very proud and a very effective young lady indeed. And we have infinitely more to offer to people who are interested in what's going to be done about what is the new concept in this whole field of race relations, rather than the old, and deeply feel that it can be done far more effectively and productively on the Republican side with far more order and tranquility than we have seen during the Democratic administration, because it is recognized that what is at stake now is no longer equal opportunity. We have a pretty good set of anti-discrimination laws now, not perfect by any means. There's still a lot to be done, especially in the way of money for their administration and the enforcement of them by the federal government itself in the federal establishment, but the network of laws is not bad. What is needed now is human dignity, the premium upon acceptability, economic, social, academic,